This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 243 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll look at the state of public broadcasting around the world with the author of a new book that claims the BBC is in crisis.
Also ahead, as Fashion Week season continues in some of the world's great sartorial hubs, we'll speak to the author who's attempted to debunk some of the stereotypes of African fashion.
And before the end of the programme, we'll speak to the director of this year's Armory Show in New York about some of the artistic treats on offer at the historic Upper East Side venue.
All that, and we'll whet your appetite with the news stories that will likely dominate the headlines in the week ahead. And we'll have some music too, all to come on this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Some weeks, Andrew, you feel like you're leaning on a door, don't you, that's a resistant door, it's a heavy door, it's a barn door, it's a something oak and it's possibly locked. This week seems like an easier door. It seems like we've swept through this week's production week for the April issue of Monocle with kind of, I don't think it's too speaking too soon to say, with a kind of gust of wind behind us.
Yeah, it's been, I tell you why. It's because at the end of almost every day, there's been an event, a nice party for people to go to.
Exactly.
It encourages people to work very fast during the day because they don't want to miss out.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good thing, isn't it?
So on Friday, we had a big staff celebration for 7 years of Monocle.
Mm-hmm.
And at lunchtime, we had Hermann's the German, who came in and made sausages for everybody. I think a sausage and a party, people work very fast.
I don't think there's any innuendo that we can get from that sentence, is there? I don't think if you put a sausage on, dangle it on the edge of a bamboo cane, on the end of a bamboo cane, who are you likely, what sort of clientele are you likely to get coming to your party, do you think?
Several gentlemen up on the floor that we work on who will come a running.
Do you like ketchup and mustard on yours, Andrew?
Yeah, I do.
Does it sting?
I had the... You just have to be careful not to dip it in the onion rings. I had the native vegetarian one.
Yeah,
actually, the vegetarian one was good because you got two of them actually.
You did,
stuffed in your sausage, in your bun.
Okay,
and it was good.
That's right. There's always a good way to get people to work faster, to lure them with the promise of a glass of Laurent Perrier, bottle of Peroni or something at the end of the day, right?
And a bratwurst.
Should we talk our listeners through the cocktails that made Wednesday night go with such a swing?
Oh yes, because we had two parties this week to celebrate.
I was going to say.
Then we had a client.
Friends of
Monocle over the last 7 years came to the new hotel that's just down the road from us, opened by Andre Bellage. And that was the first time snuck in once before, but that was the first time I'd been. It's kind of open for dinner now, but not open in the bar yet, and they don't do lunch yet, but they let us take over their bar, and what a handsome bar it is.
I particularly like the staff costumes. What?
I'm just saying. You liked the fact that the women wore jumpsuits from the 70s.
Sort of all-in-one jade green satin jumpsuit.
Yeah.
And by the look of them, they were made to measure.
Well, that's what also our art director, our head honcho, Richard Spencer Powell, he had... oddly, too many details about those jumpsuits.
I think it was probably more his art direction, his sort of curatorial, his interest in design that was leading his...
He discovered...
Making his eyes... Yeah, I won't say wonder, I'll say study.
He discovered that they were all kind of made to measure.
Yeah.
I think he was volunteering his services.
But anyway. Nice. I think it's been a good week. What better way to end it or start it? I'm always unsure of Sunday. With the Monocle Weekly, I think we've got quite a good show lined up. Armory Show, BBC in Crisis. These are big topics, Andrew. Are you willing to take them on? It's been a busy week, but we can still do it, right?
Yes, we're straddled on the fence of the cusp between Old Week and New Week, and we're ready to go with some good topics.
Right, let's kick off. Coming up first, we're going to have Danny Jacopelli's News Look Ahead. And let us get proceedings underway with our news look ahead for some of the stuff that's coming up this week. And certainly for the first time that I've been helming the show, I'd like to welcome Daniel Jacopelli to the news seat. Danny, welcome.
Far from the first time ever, though, Rob.
No, I know. I was just saying for the first time I've been
sitting here. I practically have
my
own theme song, but...
he was here last week.
Oh, really?
You weren't.
I wasn't here, no. And what sort of theme song would you like? Let's talk about, let's talk very briefly about genre.
I don't know. Something...
Daniel?
What, by Elton John?
Yeah, that would work.
Daniel's heading tonight on a plane.
Oh, look, he knows it as well.
I can see the red tail lights heading for Spain. There he is. He's got his own theme tune already. I can see Daniel waving
goodbye. Anyway.
It looks like Jock Belly.
Words by Bernie Taupin, music by Elton John, news by Daniel Jacopelli. What's going to happen next week?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu is going to the United States today. He's going to visit the White House, and he's also there for the APEC policy conference. So APEC is the biggest Israeli lobby in the U.S., hugely powerful lobby, many would say too powerful, and he's going to be speaking to them, and he's kind of coming in as a Superman kind of figure. I mean, they adore Netanyahu. And I was reading an editorial in Haaretz, and they were saying, you know, if he could only be the head of APEC, he would be liked a lot more.
And he's got a problem, hasn't he, doing a show earlier this week that he won't speak to his own press, but he loves traveling around the world, and especially he's a fan of the sort of cozy morning talk show in the US, right? He's become a bit of a specialist for that. How do you think he's going to go? How do you think he personally goes down with Obama when he's visiting?
I don't think they like each other at all.
No.
I mean, everything that I read says, you know, they kind of have extremely icy relations, especially after the sanctions whole issue, where Obama's trying very strongly not to have sanctions on Iran. And of course, Netanyahu sees Iran as an existential threat to their existence. So it's, we'll see how that goes down. He's there until Thursday, I believe. And he will be at the White House, I believe, on Monday.
I like the idea of an existential threat.
Well,
like a sort of like,
that's what they say.
Sort of postmodern Beckettian figure.
Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah, okay. That's what we like.
What next, Danny?
Moving on, it's a tale of maybe two trials. I've been trying to determine when Justin Bieber is going to trial. It's very hard to tell. A very serious trial.
Is this for the eggs?
No, this is for
the
DUI in Miami-Dade County. So he was drag racing under the influence. And
what's DUI stand for?
Driving under the influence. There's also DWI. It depends on where you live in the United States.
DUI. Sorry. It was DY. I was wondering about that.
I didn't know that he did drag.
DIY.
Anyway.
It's a new direction.
Driving with a wig. He's also being dumb for that.
Perhaps.
So that's okay. So there's two. What's the other trial?
Well, quite a more serious one. I hesitate to combine them.
Are we doing light and shade here?
Oscar Pistorius. Trial of the century in South Africa.
You know when you're driving the car and you by accident go from fifth gear to first?
Yeah.
That's what you just did.
I'm putting on my serious face now. It's not funny, guys.
And this is sort of being semi-shown on the TV live.
South Africa is doing this 24/7. They've created a special channel, a 24-hour rolling coverage channel, just to cover this trial. And
I can't help thinking that's absolutely horrible.
Yeah, well, I mean... everything.
And they are selling it like some kind of like TV
like a Hollywood,
special.
A Hollywood drama. Yeah. No, totally. It's like I said, it's the kind of the whodunit, the mystery of the century, and everybody's tuning in. It starts on Monday.
Mystery of the century.
Well,
you're getting a bit carried away there.
Well,
it's not the mystery of the century. The century's only like 5 years old anyway.
14.
5 minutes. Isn't it 2005, he said, waking up?
Monocle is celebrating its 7 years. So
we've got the new Dido album.
I have, actually.
I love that Moby.
Limp Bizkit.
Limp Bizkit. Fred Durst. Yeah.
Lizzie Stansfield.
She's got. We're gonna go into 14th gear now. Mardi Gras on Tuesday in New Orleans.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah.
Fat Tuesday. I've never been.
So this is we are allowed to race and drag for Mardi Gras, right?
Yeah. I really want to go to Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
What I was reading was kind of fairly hilarious. They have this infamous bus that they bring in it's the mobile booking site. And it's basically a big jail bus, you know, with like chains and they're bringing it so they could book people faster rather than driving them to the jail and booking them.
I love that.
It normally takes 90 minutes to take a drunk crime committing person, bring them into jail, book them, and then whatever, bring them back. And now they're going to do it like rapid fire, bring them to the bus.
A lot of people say it's a crime.
Yeah.
But I just like to, I just call it, I just want to tell you my feelings.
45 people last year were booked.
But then you
let go again once you've been booked?
I think you do, yeah.
Okay. Because I wouldn't want to be on that bus going over a bumpy road with like 45 drunk people in the back.
You'd probably need a wee, wouldn't you, as well?
Need a hose at the end of it.
The local paper says after the booking process is complete, prisoners will be loaded onto a cage-modified school bus. Once a group of 5 to 10 prisoners has been collected, they'll be taken to the sheriff's office.
That's the spirit of Mardi Gras. You've really given us a sense.
Sounds a bit like an Addison Lee with Rob after a party.
Ooh, kaboom! Let's not. Next time, I'm going to talk about Andrew talking to his bag.
Next time, I'm going to talk about you falling asleep at the table. This week.
It's a micro power nap.
Okay, next one.
And finally, it could be interesting depending on the audience. The Geneva Motor Show is on Thursday. And also on Thursday, quite a serious story. I don't know if you remember a while back, a bunch of NGOs in Russia were kind of rounded up. And so they were acting as foreign agents. That actually, on Thursday, the government is going to hear those cases.
that's Danny.
Not
that.
I like that.
He ran out of steam.
Mardi Gras on Tuesday.
They're going to put them on the bus as well.
Let's remember Mardi Gras.
Okay.
Let's remember Mardi Gras.
That was the highlight. It was a bit downhill at the end.
Danny, thank you very much indeed for your second news. Okay, your first with me. I enjoyed every minute of it, Andrew, didn't you?
I loved it. I loved the ending.
Public broadcasting can often feel like a damned if you do, a damned if you don't corner of the media world from which to earn your crust. Just last week, Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott questioned the future of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, having previously called on it to be more patriotic in its coverage of Australian affairs.
Well, here in the UK, the BBC, which is paid for by a universal licence fee, is regularly called to account for itself, be it for a piece of programming, to the payouts it offers its departing staff, to the level of the licence fee itself. Nothing too contentious there, you might think, for an organisation that is funded by the public purse. But a new book claims that the BBC is in its deepest crisis for a generation. Well, joining us now from Oxford is John Mayer, one of the editors of the book. John, thank you for joining us. Let's just first of all explain for a global audience, the BBC, it's funded still by this idea of a licence fee, which was born of a time when there were only one or two TV channels. The very foundation on what the BBC is built, do you think that still has merit?
Before we go on to that, you forgot to put in the question mark. The book is entitled, Is the BBC in Crisis? Question mark. So we're not saying firmly it is. We're asking the question. But, the BBC costs £145.60 a year, which is not very much at all. Compare that to the average Sky subscription, is about £40 a month, which is £480. But people do see it as a hypothecated tax, and they see it as a universal tax, which some people resent.
There's all sorts of scandals rocking the BBC, John. Most notably, recently, the Jimmy Savile scandal, which is a sex scandal dating right back to the 1960s, which seems to have gone through all the different strata of the BBC. There's that, but I wonder whether the real crisis, or where the other real crises come from, whether they're something to do with the internals of the BBC rather than one man sort of rampaging through the corporation.
Savile is a special case, but the BBC lives or dies on public trust. If it doesn't have public trust, then it has big problems, and I think it's stretching public trust at the moment. If you look at something like the DMI, the Digital Media Initiative, which the BBC wasted £100 million on, that's the licence fees of Glasgow they wasted on that. If you look at the payoffs for bosses, one boss got close to £1 million, and he was leaving, others got serious amounts of money. The Director General, the last Director General, was on £838,000 at one point. These are things that stretch public trust and public credibility and stretch the friendship of people like me. I mean, I'm a former BBC producer, and this book has got BBC producers in it who sort of find themselves hard pushed to defend the corporation.
But do you think that we're also caught in a kind of odd position? Because on the one hand, you're correct, that you read the popular press and they don't like the fact that people at the BBC BBC, you know, are too well paid. They don't like how money is spent even on somebody taking a taxi every now and then. And it becomes very complicated, you know, the impression that the BBC, you know, really should not be spending any money. But on the same side, if they produce a programme that looks cheap, then they get in trouble as well. And then on the other side, we seem to want them to be playing in a kind of corporate world. On the other side, we want them only to be a public broadcaster. There doesn't seem to be a very clear kind of like route ahead for them in a way.
No, I mean, the devil in the deep blue sea. I mean, you must remember that every newspaper is a competitor to the BBC. They're a competitor commercially, but also politically. That the British press is by and large right-wing, so it doesn't like something that's neutral, that's straight down the middle. So they hate the BBC for that. The local press hate the BBC because the local press is not very good and going down the tubes. And so they blame the BBC for them going down the tubes. So there's that problem. But then when the BBC produces hits, like Strictly, they say, hang on a minute, you're not supposed to do popular programmes like this. I've had an interesting media studies lesson this week. One of the chapters in my book, the former head of comms at the BBC says that Strictly will come to the end of its life in about 5 years' time. This is the head of comms, a PR man. Now, that has now become a tabloid story. The BBC will act Strictly. And it's gone all through the tabloids, and it's gone to Africa because, actually, they hate Strictly. They live off it, but they hate it. So the BBC can't do anything right, can't do anything wrong. But that having been said, they've done an awful lot wrong.
Well, let's list some of those problems. We've talked about the Savile scandal. It was George Entwistle who lasted 5 minutes in the role of Director General. I wonder whether we talked about news. I know Michael Grade said fairly recently that the BBC should just do news, that it shouldn't involve itself in entertainment.
Well, he didn't say that, actually. You see, that's the press getting the wrong end of the stick. Grade is in the book. Grade's evidence is based on the chat. What he says is the BBC should in-house do news and current affairs, and everything else should be put out to independents, but they should be broadcasting drama, entertainment, everything else. So, you know, Grade is not saying just turn it into a news service, because he wouldn't believe that, nor does anybody else. But, you know, the BBC has a lot of enemies, and more enemies than friends at the moment.
Now, if we take it then that, you know, they're not going to please all of the audience all of the time, especially when some of that audience is running a popular press, what can they do, though, that would help them win over at least a few more people to their side?
Well, what the BBC can and should do always is make bloody good programmes. If it makes good programmes, then it will always have public support. If it makes programmes, you know, who do people go to on national events? They go to the BBC. Who do people go to for big news events? They go to the BBC. Who do people go to for big events like Olympics? They go to the BBC. So the BBC is part of the national structure. And the BBC itself is actually pretty not very good at selling itself to its own public. So, you know, you get this rather wimpy little thing called This Week on the BBC. You know, the BBC should actually be saying, look, we are the BBC. We give you this week after week after week after week, day after day. Good programmes.
Do you think that's one of the key problems? I've always thought this, actually, John, that the BBC isn't almost arrogant enough about how good it can be, that it perhaps needs a little bit more of a figurehead, less of a bureaucrat and more of a leader at the top of it, more of a sort of a visionary.
It needs to stop being a shrinking violet and actually, you know, become a broadcaster. I mean, Greg Dyke was very good at that, selling the BBC, you know, to the world and selling the BBC to itself. You know, it shouldn't be afraid. They make bloody good programmes day in, day out. I mean, some things they don't do well. I mean, I'm sitting here in Oxford. I'm not a huge fan of BBC local radio. I'm not sure what it's there for. I'm not a huge fan of the orchestras. I'm not sure what they're there for. But, you know, by and large, if you can go to BBC One or Two on an average night and find a good programme. BBC Three... question mark. BBC Four question mark should probably be folded into BBC Two.
And John, the other interesting thing is, you know, before we just came down to make this interview with you, we were talking to some of the team upstairs who pointed out that actually there's quite a lot of young women and men who work for us. They don't own a TV. They're watching all the programmes via the iPlayer, which allows people to watch the BBC content for free. You don't need a licence for that. And they have no intention of buying a TV. They like watching what they watch on their laptops. Do you think part of the problem is for the BBC that culturally it is changing how we consume our kind of TV, and that they may just kind of fall by the wayside because of that?
I've got a son who does exactly that, who doesn't have a TV license, watches it on his laptop. But the BBC has to get used to that. I mean, if you followed Tony Hall's speech at the Oxford Convention this Wednesday, he said actually people should have to buy a license for the iPlayer and for their laptops. I think he's probably whistling in the wind there. They have to find a way of making it so when people get the TV on their laptops, on their tablets and so on, which is increasingly how people are going to watch TV, they see the need to have a license for that.
We'll go back to the beginning, John, and we'll start with the title of your book. We'll put that question mark back. Is the BBC in crisis? But do you have any prescriptions for its future in the book as well?
Well, the prescriptions of the future is A, has to seriously think about itself, produce programs, fire quite a lot of people. I mean, you know, I used to work in the BBC. There are far too many layers of people in there. They could get rid of so many of them. And also think of what it's doing and sell itself to its audience. You know, get them to imagine life without the BBC. And believe me, that would be pretty horrific.
All right, John, well, thank you very much for joining us. That was John Mayer, one of the editors of the book, Is the BBC in Crisis? It's time now for some music. Now, earlier this week, the death of one of Spain's cultural heroes was announced. The flamenco guitarist Paco de Lucía, who was 66, was widely regarded as having resurrected the art form that was for so long marginalised and dismissed as an unsophisticated one. Well, de Lucía changed all that. Let's hear a piece of his work now. This is Entre Dos Aguas.
That was Entre Dos Aguas by Paco de Lucía there, who died this week, age 66. It's a very sad story.
Are you pulling rank with your Spanish accent? You did some Spanish lessons. Are you pulling rank?
I'm just going to tell you, during this week, somebody, one of the producers, had a very bright idea to play a little bit of his music as a homage at the end of the show instead of the news bed. So while I had flamenco music playing, I had to summarise the stories that we had done. So it went something, ooh, there was like this going in the background, there was me going, and Ukraine, they have done. It was very bad.
43 people died in Ukraine with the flamenco soundtrack.
There were castanets going as another revolution happened. Oh, but anyway, you're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. The Weekly continues after this short break. Don't go anywhere.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Now, the beginning of any year brings an embarrassment of riches for anyone with an eye for the finer things in fashion. Well, one part of the world that doesn't seem to feature too prominently in highbrow discussions of the latest trends in fashion is Africa.
Well, one London-based fashion designer is trying to shake off the stereotypes that African fashion often finds itself couched in with a new book, Fashion Africa. And I'm delighted to say that the book's author, Jacqueline Shaw, joins us now. Jacqueline, first of all, congratulations on an amazing book. A really good run through African fashion, and it makes you realise it's not all the kind of stereotypes we think of. Of course, there's the big patterns, which are important, and the colour and the use of motifs, which are from Africa. But what's interesting, I think, first of all, is the number of these companies, which are not in the obvious kind of fashion centres. So maybe Nairobi and Lagos, you'd imagine to have a bit of a fashion industry. Yeah. But you've got people from Namibia, you've got people from across the whole country, and also lots of businesses which have got kind of maybe one foot in Africa and one foot in Copenhagen, or one foot in Africa and one foot in Paris. Just give us a little bit of a snapshot of the range of people that you managed to find for this book, and where the heartland of African fashion really is.
Yeah, like you said, there is quite a big range of people. There's those who maybe are Europeans who have just had an experience, an African experience, and they just fell in love and they're now creating product there, working alongside artisans and production units. And then you have the designers who are doing new things now, like, you know, the Lagos designers or the South African designers who live there, based there, from there. And they're not necessarily all using so-called African print or African materials. They may just be just doing fashion because they love creativity. So, you know, we have, like you mentioned, Namibia. We have Das Brothers Vellies, and we've got Jewel by Lisa from Lagos, Kiko Romeo from Kenya. I can go, well, wow, I'm trying to think now. There's over 40 now.
There's a lot. Kiko Romeo, that'd be a good stage name. I ain't used that.
It could be.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to freelance under another name. I wonder whether you talk about making product there, Jacqueline. Yeah. And I wonder whether that's kind of part of the acid test of the success of African fashion, that it breaks out of becoming African fashion in quotes and just and makes money, and it's about brands and stuff as much as couture and these name designers that you talk about.
Yeah, I think the designers really just want to be recognised. And if something is made in China, you're not necessarily saying it's a Chinese designer or Chinese fashion. If something is made, you know, in Europe, doesn't necessarily have to be European fashion. You just base it on the designers. You know, Gaultier is just Gaultier.
Yeah.
You know, Donna Karan is just Donna Karan. Not necessarily she has to be, because she's American.
Yeah.
If you can say she's American, she's got a different history. But they just want to be recognised and just be in the same level field as designers from around the world. And they're just really, it's like a small fight to just say, we're here, look what we're doing, we can compete. And so me doing the book like this is to really create a platform, because the books they were out before, I found that they were very traditional and they had this, for lack of a better word, tribal kind of feel about it. And I wanted to branch out and say, there's a new Africa.
Yeah.
You know, The Economist magazine is telling us about this new Africa that's branching out. And I wanted to kind of do that through the book, but make it glossy.
There's that, you alluded to that, the kind of orientalist idea of kind of going, well, look at this, how exotic it is, and these lovely colours. And it's like, well, it just happens to be stuff that's from Africa, and there are different minds and different tastes going into it.
Yeah.
On the subject of brands, is that something, are there brands within this book that people can go, people will see stuff on their high street, whether in the US or in Asia or the UK, that comes from Africa that isn't maybe just inspired by it?
Yeah, I mean, they're all, I mean, I have production companies originally, but there are brands in there. There's labels like Makio, she actually, a Nigerian designer. I love her fashion because what she's doing is using what is traditional, but she's modernizing it. So she uses a technique called adire, which is like a dyeing technique, and she uses that in a modern way.
Can I ask you another question around that production idea, which is, I know in the past when you saw some of these amazing fabrics that people wore in West Africa, there was an interesting backstory that often they were African prints and African colours, but they were often made in the UK. The actual cloths, they weren't actually manufactured in Africa. As this kind of little revolution happens around African fashion, are you seeing actually much production happening in Africa, or is it still very complicated actually getting stuff made there?
It is. I mean, a lot of that fabric you may be talking about is the wax print, which a lot of it is associated with colonialism, but it was also inspired from Indonesian batik technique. So it's got a history through to Indonesia, into Holland, and then into Africa. And that was associated with Africa. But there's challenges there. The processing of the materials is an issue. So you have cotton grown in Africa, but then it's exported. A lot of it is exported, then it's brought back as a material, so it's losing value. And this is one of the challenges that is happening. So to make these African so-called prints in Africa, it is done there. There are companies, you know, you have companies doing this, but it is a challenge to make it happen because of machinery or technology, which is lacking. But that's why, you know, I'm part of the campaign team, so to speak, trying to revive that. And there's interest. I get companies and clients that want to work with me, looking at ways of getting into Africa and doing things. Textile producers yeah, people want to do these things. So it's slowly happening, but it's going to take a while.
And what's the vibe? Having travelled around the continent to write the book and to photograph the book, is there a kind of collegiate atmosphere amongst these designers? Do they feel that they're part of a movement, or are they nice and bitchy like European fashion designers?
Isn't it all fashion designers, darling? No, I think they're just doing what they're doing because they love it and they just want to get recognised. I mean, just even for my blog, I'm always getting, you know, press releases. Can you showcase? Because they know that they need to have, like, media. They need to have people seeing what they're doing in order to get recognised, in order to get their name out there. They want to compete. But you can get the same in the UK. Designers coming out of school, college, they want to compete with the big names and get onto the fashion weeks. And it's a challenge. But for the African ones, it's even more because then they need the money to get forward, and that's where it may stop for them if they can't get the financing.
And Jacqueline, you know, we've seen a kind of an emerging middle class across Africa as more wealth is generated on the continent, whether that's kind of oil wealth in Luanda or whether it's manufacturing wealth in South Africa. Mm. Is that homegrown money helping inspire these companies? Because again, when you look at some of the designs you've got in there, yeah, again, it may be using kind of a cloth or a colour that we associate with African fashion, but the cut suddenly is really dramatic and thin and European. And I wonder if that's being born out of, you know, a mobile middle class who, you know, yeah, they can shop in Paris if they want to, or they could shop in Africa.
Well, I mean, that question of the middle class, I mean, some of it is based on what makes it a middle class. What is that bottom figure to make them middle class? And maybe in the European countries, it's quite a high figure, but in Africa, it's, you know, if you're earning the equivalent of £5 a week, that makes you middle class in particular countries. So it's a bit of a debatable topic.
I wonder where they study, these people you talked about, you know, everyone coming out of school and wanting to get their collection on the catwalk and stuff. Are they schooled all over the world and end up going back to Africa, or is that where they're learning their trade?
Yeah, there's some great schools I've visited, you know, in Kenya as well as in South Africa and in Ghana that are doing great things and bringing out some amazing designers. And they're really trying to get on board doing their own shows and collaborating. But I mean, there's also the designers who have gone to the diaspora and they're coming back to Africa and bringing things that they've learned. Maybe they've gone and worked with designers in Italy or in Paris or in the UK, and then they're coming back to Africa because they want to. There's a lot of that, Africans going back now, and I think it's all the rage. They want to go back and show, this is what I want to do back home. I don't just want to do it in Europe. I want to do it back home.
And Jacqueline, a particular favourite in the book?
Oh, gosh, I can't.
I'm sure they'll still read your blog. Go, tell us one.
They're same. I mean, one of them I always plug, and you know, she's off to Cuba at the moment, so she hears this. I'm very jealous. But Chichia, and I love Christine Mundo. I love her brand, Chichia, because she uses traditional fabric from Tanzania. She uses kangas, and she just makes fun prints, fun designs, fun dresses, just quite young, quite feminine. And I just love what she's doing. You know, she works with people in Tanzania. She does some things in London. She's always in between two countries, but she does some beautiful pieces. And that's what I think African fashion should be. Just be fun and people should just enjoy it.
So that's Chichia. Well, yeah. Chichia, if you're listening, put the check in the post.
Exactly.
Jacqueline Shaw, author of Fashion Africa. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Now, coming up after this short break, we'll take a sneak peek of one of New York's most anticipated contemporary art fairs at one of the city's most historic venues, the Armory Show. Stay with us.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We're going to have a break for a little bit of music now. This is Run Alone by Sweden's The Majority Says.
If I couldn't steal a broken heart, I would buy the field, nothing at all, I would buy the sea, a mystery.
That was Run Alone by Sweden's Finest, The Majority Says. Now, the New York art world is preparing itself for this year's Armory Show, one of the most established fixtures on the city's art fair circuit. And this year's show, which opens next week, has already promised to draw in parts of the city during the event. Some of the city's city bikes are even being customised in rather beautiful fashion by the Chinese artist Zhu Zhen.
And I'm delighted to say that the fair's director, Noah Horovitz, joins us on the line from New York City. Noah, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Now, we mentioned a Chinese artist in our introduction there. It's a big year for the Armory and linking hands with China. Talk me through how this is going to work and the decision behind that, Noah.
Sure. Each year at the Armory, we have a regional focus section as part of the fair. It's an initiative that began at the fair 5 years ago with Berlin and has migrated through Latin America, the Nordic region, and America last year, as an homage to the 1913 Armory Show, which is where our name comes from. And this year we've turned our attention to China. It's a region, of course, that's been on the top of everybody's radar socially, politically, and of course culturally recently. There's been huge interest around the growing and expanding market there, both in the gallery landscape and also at auction, of course. And at the same time, we felt that this younger generation of artists is yet to really come into full visibility, certainly in the American context. So we've approached Philip Tenari, who's the director of the Ulin Center for Contemporary Art in Beijing. And he's worked with us over this past year to invite 17 different galleries from the mainland and Hong Kong to come to the fair this year, many of whom have never shown at a fair outside of Asia before. So it's a really exciting initiative for us, and will deeply color the fair both on-site through gallery and booth presentations, as well as a number of different projects on and around the piers. And there will also be a weekend-long symposium that brings together a lot of leading scholars, journalists, museum directors, artists, etc., that are deeply involved with Chinese contemporary art today.
No, we referenced the city bikes there in the introduction. Now, most of these great art fairs around the world, they tend to have their backs to the city a little bit. They're a little bit, you know, for the elite, and they're about, you know, lots of money. But are you trying to deliberately, you know, court the city a little bit more this year?
Well, we court the city every year. Armory Arts Week is a public initiative of ours that brings together dozens of cultural institutions in and around the city. We work closely with NYC & Co., which is the official bureau that represents the city's interests. Mayor Bloomberg opened our fair with Glenn Lowry, the director of MoMA, last year. So the Armory really is a fixture in the cultural calendar of New York City, and it's a real source of pride for us that it's not just about the commerce that's on-site at the piers, but that this is really the premier cultural week for the primary market gallery and artistic segment in New York that spills over into over a dozen art fairs throughout the city, and then also all these great culture initiatives that also run concurrent with the Armory.
I mean, it is a real week of sort of cultural initiatives, and there's a lot of curatorial stuff going on in town at the time of the fair, isn't there, Noah? But in terms of sales, obviously a lot of galleries still sell their work from booths there. How do you refresh that experience for galleries and for the people that are going to experience all the art?
Sure. Well, I think sales are obviously, in a way, the key crux of what an art fair delivers in terms of bringing buyers and sellers together. So that's very much at the core of what we do. But art is not just about buying and selling. It's about learning and educating and seeing new things. And we have a rich program of talks that commence on the Thursday of the fair and run through the weekend. And then there's a lot of other initiatives, museum programming, and other types of events in and around the city that, you know, that only a fraction of those touch upon the actual buyers and sellers of art. But, you know, the Armory is really a fixture that has broad reach to a wide museum and gallery-going audience in New York.
And in terms of that, we talked about, you know, sales are the crux of an art fair. dealing with China and as I say, sort of, you know, holding hands with China this year. Is that very much about access to a new art market, or is that also a kind of curatorial initiative?
Well, it's about both at the same time. They're not really separable from one and the other. On the one hand, this is absolutely an opportunity and an initiative to try to give some of these, this new generation of artists, as well as the galleries in China, real international visibility. And New York City, despite the rampant globalization of the art market, is still very much the core of the marketplace for modern contemporary art. So to be able to give that kind of a platform to galleries and their artists, and then the extended rungs of curators and museums and collectors that are all part of the Chinese art world is a real honor for us. At the same time, it's an opportunity to bring something new to our audiences in New York. A lot of the collectors and even the institutions throughout America are not nearly as familiar, of course, with what's going on in China as the local constituent is on the other side of the world. So this is equally a platform to present these galleries and artists to our audiences here. And of course, at the base of that, we certainly hope that sales come out of that, but new contacts, connections, other exhibition opportunities, press, et cetera, you know, which is all part of the ecology of our system and really what we strive to do.
And Noah, tell me, we know that, you know, a couple of very famous examples of the Chinese authorities being very cautious about how artists, you know, represent the country and what they do. And have you found that any complexity for you engaging with galleries and the kind of work that you're going to show? Do you feel it's an image that will surprise people and even challenge, you know, some Chinese people as well?
Yeah, I mean, to speak totally frankly, we've not had any of those initiatives in undertaking the China Focus initiative. Clearly, you know, it's something that I think the art world in mainland China deals with on a daily basis. But as I've come to appreciate, a lot of what's blown up in the international media is just one of many factors that the Chinese artists and galleries are dealing with. There's a whole web of additional complexities, as there are here as well. I think in terms of content, one thing that we're very interested in presenting at the fair this year is a side of Chinese contemporary art that's not altogether well known, and that's not necessarily what we might think of Chinese contemporary art. There's a lot of artists that are working with conceptual modes and abstraction and broader sets of generalized contemporary artistic practices that, you know, I think will be very familiar to our audiences, but with a uniquely Chinese twist. So I think combating some of the stereotypes and predispositions that we have about Chinese contemporary art is also very fundamental to what we're trying to do.
And I wondered, Noah, what your style is, what the trick to running an art fair is, whether you have to be out front kind of leading it, or whether the success of the Armory Show is the fact that kind of nobody knows who the director of it is.
Well, I think it's a little bit of everything. I building relationships with our galleries and the web of collectors and institutions that we work with, you know, is a very intense and it's a year-long day-to-day initiative. I think a key part of our business, as any business, is really building relationships, giving people a reason to come, and the understanding and confidence that they're in good hands once they're with you, and that all of your interests are aligned. So we do a lot of traveling. We go to the other fairs. We visit the galleries in person and are, you know, deeply involved with supporting the museums and all the different types of institutions and actors that we work with at our fair.
And just finally, then, how rosy is the market?
Well, the market's been very strong recently. Obviously, the fall auctions, there were a number of records that fell, and certainly at the fall fairs and capped off with Art Basel Miami in December, things were very heady. As we head into the new year, the Armory will be the first of the major international fairs to kick off the spring calendar. So I think a lot of people's eyes will be on how the fair does and what the feedback is from the galleries. But we have high hopes going into this. It's also very exciting for us that next week the Whitney Biennial will be opening concurrent with the fair, which brings its own energy and its own community of supporters to the city. So we're really excited for next week.
Fab. Well, Noah, thank you very much for joining us. Have a good fair. It is indeed a big week for New York next week. That was Noah Horovitz, who is the director of the Armory Show in New York. And there we have it, Andrew. That was the 243rd edition of the Monocle Weekly. It was kind of snappy.
I've really enjoyed today.
I enjoyed today as well. It was good, wasn't it? I liked all our guests. It was nice being in the studio with Daniel Jacopelli. I always think he's quite a serious-minded person when he's doing his news stories for the actual live shows. When he's doing his news look ahead, he's got there's a surprising amount of levity there.
And I think we'll have to let him go to New Orleans next year as well.
Do you want to see the Instagrams of him in a dress?
I want
Danny in a cross
I want skirt. To see him being processed on the bus.
Yeah.
And that's not a euphemism.
Anyway, moving
Hose
along.
Down on the prison bus. No, it was a very good show. We looked at the BBC. We had a nice chat about the world of art.
Yeah, I think the Army Show is always an interesting one, that.
I've never been.
Because it's sort of good. I've been to it once. It's I kind of think Frieze might sort of... I don't know, Frieze has kind of stolen quite a lot of the march on it. But I think the Army Show, they're kind of proud of it. It feels more part of New York City in a way. But it's not always maybe quite as good.
Yeah, it was great that he said that actually it is an event that kind of bleeds out into the city, and the New York City itself is a sponsor. Because actually, that is a slight thing about Frieze. I love Frieze in London. I think it's an amazing show, and everything they do is incredible. But it doesn't really... there is an open day, obviously, for the public, but it kind of doesn't come out of the park. It doesn't come out of those tents. It feels a little bit contained for the public, I think.
You need to go to more of the parties, then. We should do that again this year, Andy. We should get our party trousers on.
Okay.
Yeah.
And get processed in the back of the Addison Lee.
Exactly. The Frieze prison bus. I've been on a few of those. Should we thank the gang?
Let's thank the gang.
Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll be here again next week, probably, won't we?
We will be.
It's inevitable, isn't it?
You
Do you know
me.
Where I'm going tomorrow?
Where?
The Arctic. So I'll have some tales to tell from there.
Mm, yeah. That'd be nice.
But for the time being...
Do you think they'll have Arctic roll? Anyway,
we'll see, won't we? We'll see if the bed doesn't have any sides on it.
I'm coming if they've got Arctic roll.
God.
I used to love that.
Do you know what one of my favourite puddings is?
No.
I like to baked Alaska.
Ooh, that's nice as well.
A little climate change.
They're all Arctic puddings.
They all are.
Yeah.
let's say goodbye for me, Robert Bound.
Me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.